Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name's Jamie Loftus.
My name's Caitlin Durante.
And this is our podcast about the representation of women in movies. Is that correct?
That's correct. Jamie, would you say that the representation of women in movies is like generally like pretty good?
I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting take.
Just a general, very, very bad. How many episodes have we been going for now? 5 million?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the general consensus.
Oh, this comes as a surprise to me, but I'm interested to hear more.
It's okay. I have to 50 first dates you every morning and remind you.
Why haven't we done that movie?
Oh God, that movie would do so
poorly. Never seen it.
It's very fucked up, but I really loved it when it came out. I thought it was the most romantic thing ever. It's spoiler alert. Adam Sandler has to show Drew Barrymore this like weird DVD he made to like tell her it's 2006 or something every morning. And he's like, so all this stuff happened. The Clinton administration is over. Also, 9/11 happened. Also, Arnold Schwarzenegger is in office. Like, it's the events he chooses to cover and the order is so wild. It's an insane movie. But I really liked it when it came out. But I almost never want to see it again, just so I can.
Well, we got to cover it. So sorry, but you got to see it again.
Oh no! Shout out to all my 50 first dates.
Does that mean it'll be 100 first dates for you?
It'll be exactly 2 laps of first dates.
So we use the Bechdel test as a way to initiate a larger conversation about women in film. And the Bechdel test, if you're not familiar, is a media test created by Alison Bechdel. Mm-hmm. It requires that a piece of media has 2 female identifying characters. They have to have names. They must speak to each other, and their conversation cannot be about men. And for our standard, it's just a 2-line exchange, very low bar, and yet it still does not happen nearly enough.
Yeah.
So that's what we're working with here.
I'm excited for the movie we're talking about today. It's one of your favorites, am I correct?
Yeah, I would say that it's one of my favorites. Cool. Although upon this rewatch, I was like, oh boy.
There's some stuff.
Some things happen. But before we get into it, let's introduce our guests.
Yay.
We've got today, very exciting, the hosts of Malton on Movies podcast. It's Jesse and Leonard Malton.
Hello.
Hello.
Can I tell you when I first became aware of this?
Yeah.
It was as a parent. When I started taking Jessie to movies when she was a little girl, and I became alarmed at the lack of role models for her.
Yeah.
I don't know how enlightened you would rate me as being. I like to think I am.
Uh-huh.
And so when Jessie was growing up, we'd go to these Saturday morning or Sunday morning screenings that they have here in LA for family-friendly movies. That's how they have their media screenings.
Mm-hmm.
One time we went to see The Karate Kid Part 3.
Classic.
A film that no one would call a classic. And
how dare
that
you.
Got generally poor reviews. Mm-hmm. But Hilary Swank is a key character in that movie.
She's the lead.
Oh.
Along with Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah.
And I came out with a different point of view about that movie than almost any of my critic colleagues, because I was watching it through her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it's not a very good movie, but it has a nice lesson, a nice moral for her.
Yeah.
I liked the takeaway from that movie. That was my first kind of, I don't know if you call it an epiphany, but it was a realization that if you're trying to be a responsible parent, an enlightened parent, and especially in this case, the parent of a daughter, there are other considerations besides, is it great writing? Is it outstanding cinema? It's the takeaway.
Right,
sure.
And I refer to that all the time because it made such an impression on both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Karate Kid 3, who knew? Right. Who knew it was such a monumental film?
It's so funny because it's like, as recently as, you know, when we were growing up, there were still like relatively slim pickings for positive role models for girls outside of, you know, the Disney princesses that we've talked to death on this show.
Yeah.
But, you know, finding active young girl roles, like I think almost everyone I grew up with was like, oh yeah, Harriet the Spy and Matilda. Like those were the two little girls.
Okay, so Pleasantville.
Pleasantville.
What are each of your history and relationship with this movie?
It's one of my favorite movies ever.
Yeah.
I loved it ever since the first time I saw it. And I remember seeing it and obsessing with it, you know, over it. But yes, it's one of my favorites. I know damn near every word. I love it. My parents, though, had not seen it, I think, since it came out.
Yeah.
And so I said to my dad, do you remember it? And he said, I do, but not as well. And my mom was the same thing. She couldn't remember exactly. So we sat down, the three of us, one evening and watched the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part for me was watching the two of them. And they were really enjoying it because I didn't need to watch it again.
Sure.
I know it. But I liked watching them watch it.
And so you as a family watch each other watch movies because you were watching Jesse watch Karate Kid.
I suppose that's true.
Well, it is true. I'm very much, I'm a people watcher anyway. I'm an only child.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much like I sit in corners and stare at people. So with this, for me, I kept watching the two of them. And when it ended, my mom said, I can't believe I don't remember this movie. I love this. This is so good.
Mm-hmm.
She was really, really pleased with it. I think you had a similar reaction.
I did. Really pleasant rediscovery
for
me.
Because
I had not seen it since it came out. I come to it from a slightly different perspective than any of you, just on account of the fact I'm older. I grew up watching Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best, and Ozzie and Harriet, and all of those TV shows that didn't take place in the past. That was my present.
Right.
That was my present day. So I lived my life and absorbed what they were telling me was the ideal of American life.
Mm-hmm.
I was a baby boomer, and these were baby boomer shows in the post-World War II era. And they were hugely popular. And it all had long runs, those three shows I just named, and then endless reruns.
Mm-hmm.
So they were always there. They were part of the fabric of American life.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, what's your history?
I think that this was a movie that I feel like was on IFC or the Sundance Channel like constantly when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw this movie a bunch of times in high school, aided by my Tobey Maguire crush, which really made me, very likely to watch this movie more than once. And I always really liked it. I hadn't seen it in, I think, 4 or 5 years. And there were some things that stood out to me at this point that I feel almost a little silly for not registering for me sooner.
Same.
But I mean, in general, I still think it's a really fun movie. I forgot how emotionally affected I was by it. And I really like it.
Yeah, it is a movie that I really love as well. Although, as you said, Jamie, there are some beats that happen, especially like toward the end of Act 2, where I'm like, oh, you're introducing this metaphor. Oh, and then, okay, we'll talk about them.
Miles Gray is upstairs, and we were like, oh, yeah, we're covering Pleasantville today. He's like, oh, yeah, the movie about racism with only white people in it? And we were like, yes. And he was like, oh, cool.
Yeah. So we'll dig into that in a bit. But, I first saw this, I think, in probably – I mean, it came out in 98. I think I saw it in, like, 2000 and have been watching it pretty steadily since then. But I'm excited to dive in.
Yeah.
I'll run through the recap and then we'll go from there. So we meet David, that is Tobey Maguire's character. He is a teenager, he's in high school, I think they're seniors, I'd imagine. He's a bit of a nerdy type, and he's obsessed with a show called Pleasantville, which is this old-timey, black and white, very wholesome,
Leave It to Beaver.
It's also Father Knows Best.
Yes.
And in this show, Pleasantville, it's about a family with a mom and a dad and a teenage son named Bud and his sister Mary Sue.
So, very nuclear.
Very nuclear America. Family unit. Yeah. And then we meet David's twin sister, Jennifer. She's played by Reese Witherspoon. Mm-hmm. She is this popular girl in school. She likes this bad boy. And she has made plans with him to watch this concert on MTV night. But it's at the same exact time as this Pleasantville marathon is happening that David wants to watch.
This is a great 1998 problem. There's a lot of 1998 problems at the beginning of this movie that I very much enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. So they're fighting over the remote, and it flings against the wall accidentally and shatters. So this TV repairman shows up magically right then, and he sees how big of a fan David is of the show Pleasantville, and he gives him this special remote control.
You just said Don Knotts. Yeah. See, I would say Don Knotts! Barney Fife from the Andy Griffith Show. The nervous man from the Steve Allen Show. I grew up with Don Knotts. At Gary Ross, the filmmaker, very cannily and deliberately cast Don Knotts in that role because he knew it would get the kind of reaction I just had from aging boomers.
All the Don Knotts heads are coming
that's
out.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's totally what they're called.
But I interrupted.
That's what the recap's all about.
So they've got this special remote control now, and David and Jennifer continue to fight over it, and they accidentally hit this button that sucks them into the world of Pleasantville.
I like to wonder what happened to the two actors in Pleasantville.
Right.
I'm like, where did they go to the 1990s? That would be fun, but we just don't know what happens
to
them.
Pleasantville 2.
Yeah.
No. Unpleasantville.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're just horrified by 90s culture the whole time.
Right, because David becomes Bud and Jennifer becomes Mary Sue.
Right.
So they're like, what the frick? What? Get us out of here. Like, what's happening? And the Don Knotts character is like, no, you're staying. It begs the question why this man is going around looking for teenagers to replace the current cast of Pleasantville.
Like, I love his rationale.
No.
Like, he's just like, I've been looking for people to do this for years. You're like, why, Don Knotts?
Wouldn't that ruin the show? Which, as we see, it does.
It does.
Like, why would he do that?
I'm like, you know, I don't have to know, but I am curious why that was his.
I never really questioned the logic of it until this recent rewatch, but I was like, why does he do that?
See, I just don't question those things.
Yeah.
Like, that's the whole meeting on a movie's terms. It's like, if you're saying that you want to send them back there, then that's where they go.
Yep.
I trust Don Knotts.
That's right.
To move the plot forward.
That's right.
So they realize that they have to play along existing in the world of Pleasantville until Don Knotts shows up again and is willing to, like, discuss sending them back to their actual time. And so then they meet their mom and dad, Betty and George Parker. That's played by Joan Allen and William H. Macy. So David has an easy time fitting into Pleasantville because he knows the show so well. Mm-hmm. But Jennifer is like, this place fucking sucks because it's like this utopia of, like, wholesome pureness. No one has sex. Like, books are blank. Nothing burns. Like, all
everyone's
this stuff.
Everyone's eating meat and cheese in gigantic stacks.
Right. But then this character, Skip Martin, played by Paul Walker, is like, hey, Mary Sue, I like you. Let's go on a date.
Paul Walker is great in this movie.
He is.
He's such a little cutie pie. Watching him be all bamboozled and what was the part where he's just like, I don't know what's happening to my body. I was like, oh my God, Paul Walker has a boner and he doesn't know what's going on. It's a great scene.
So she takes him to Lover's Lane and they get into some heavy petting. And
Caitlin.
I know. I'm so sorry.
Oh my God.
I'm so sorry.
This is a family show.
Which is all new to Skip, as you just hinted at, Jamie, because, like, again, everyone in Pleasantville is basically asexual. So at the end of the night, Skip drives past this, like, rose bush, and one of the roses is no longer in black and white. It's red. And we're like,
the color of sin?
Are this new bud and Mary Sue perhaps changing things in Pleasantville? So now this sort of incites these changes where teens are making out. They're listening to rock music.
There's that great scene where Paul Walker tells all the other teenage boys about sex. And yeah. They're like, what's that?
Oh, yes.
And then no one can shoot a basketball anymore. It's great.
And then more things are showing up in color. And then Bud's boss at the diner, Mr. Johnson, that's Jeff Daniels' character. He's like learning to be more independent and he's enjoying the changes. And he's like, I love painting. I want to paint more. But Bud is sort of like resistant to things changing. He's like, let's maintain the status quo here. And
because
also
Bud's family life is terrible. His parents are divorced. Right. They mm-hmm. fight all the time. So for him, Pleasantville is the escape he
exactly.
dreams of. So the reason he doesn't want things to change, because he says, I love the idea of having my mom and dad home and loving each other and dinner on the table every night. Mm-hmm. Whereas Reese Witherspoon's character is saying, why the hell am I in this horrible bra and right. and I'm not allowed to talk to boys. There are no toilets here.
Right.
There, you know, all those sorts of things.
Yeah. All of which were true in Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet.
Right. There were no toilets?
No, you never saw a bathroom. Well,
oh.
you could see a bathroom.
Okay.
You see a mirror, a mm-hmm. vanity, a sink and a mirror.
Right.
But there was, it was kind of a joke.
Right.
You never saw a toilet.
Yeah. And the beds, like married
oh,
couples
separated.
Separate beds.
Separate beds.
I always think of I Love Lucy for that.
Yeah, right. Same.
Yeah, I Love Lucy is the same era
yeah.
and the same ground rules.
Yeah.
You may know that when Lucille Ball became pregnant in real life,
mm-hmm.
They wrote it into the show. So Lucy Ricardo was pregnant. They couldn't use the word pregnant.
Yeah.
I didn't know. Whoa. Yeah. What did they say?
Gregnant.
Expecting. She's expecting.
Oh, okay.
But those shows were, even at the time, but we didn't criticize them for that.
Mm-hmm.
They were not just idealistic. They were antiseptically idealist.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no four-letter words. There were no double entendres.
Mm-hmm.
There was no violence.
There was no irony.
No irony.
Yeah.
It was all straight-faced and sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And America loved, America embraced these shows,
mm-hmm.
America of that time,
mm-hmm.
embraced these shows fully and wholeheartedly because they represented what was considered the ideal. And yes, they were all white.
Yeah.
They were whiter than white.
Mm-hmm.
And this black and white TV show presents a world that he would be very comfortable living in.
It's his right. escape.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
It would bring him happiness, he feels.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the next major thing that happens in the story is that Mary Sue teaches her mom about sex and masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
And then her mom gets into the bathtub, has a little fun little time with herself. That's what I call masturbation. I know. I'm so sorry. and she has an orgasm that causes a tree to spontaneously combust outside.
Which is what happens every time a woman comes.
True.
That's how you know.
Yeah. That's how you know.
Which is not, more people should be talking about that.
I know.
Yeah. That's why there are so many forest fires.
So then Bud goes to the fire department and then has to teach them how to put out fires. But this incites a curiosity in people where they're like, well, fires? But also, what's outside of Pleasantville? And what are these books about? And
right.
this girl named Margaret shows an interest in Bud, and they end up going out. And then Bud starts to, like, open up to things changing.
Right.
Meanwhile, Betty is vibing with Mr. Johnson. Mary Sue is turning down sex with Skip to Reed. Instead.
Right.
And then
for the first time
yeah. time in her life, pretty much. Yeah. And then George, their dad, is freaking out about his like dinner not being ready change. On the table for him. Yeah, he's right. freaking out about change. As is the mayor and a bunch of other like old men in the community. And they are very resistant to all this change. Meanwhile, like the TV repair man is like, what are you guys doing to Pleasantville? And Bud's like, screw you. Like,
this is what you wanted, Don Knotts.
Yeah.
You've made your bed.
So basically the mayor is like, make Pleasantville great again, and tries to enforce like segregation because all these people are turning to color, and
they hit you over the head with what they're
metaphor,
doing.
Metaphor, yeah.
Like, well, they're afraid of the other.
The others.
Right. And then but they go so far as to say like coloreds.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like they.
Right. And
they go for it.
We'll unpack that. There's like Proud Boys who are like burning books and vandalizing storefronts and stuff like that.
And also, Betty and
Mr. Johnson.
Betty and Mr. Johnson fall in love.
They're beautiful. Out there fricking.
I love it.
And the mayor creates this like code of conduct that prohibits all the stuff that has been changing about Pleasantville. And then in an act of defiance.
It's very Footloose. It's like no more dancing and fun music.
Right.
Only John Philip Sousa marches for you kids.
So in an act of defiance, Bud and Mr. Johnson paint a mural.
Objectively ugly mural.
It's but
I like the message.
Right. It's depicting everything that's been happening lately.
In vivid colors.
Very vivid colors.
There's a copy of my favorite part that I thought was silly on the mural was a copy of Catcher in the Rye flying to heaven.
Yes.
I was like, oh my God. Right. But sure, why not?
So the two of them are put on trial. Bud is defending them against the mayor, and he's trying to prove the point of like, well, maybe some things are better than pleasant, like stuff like being silly or being sexy. And then he gets his dad to turn to color, and then the mayor gets so pissed off that he turns to color. And then everyone goes outside, and the whole town is in color, and everything's changed for the better, is the message of the movie.
Right. And then Tobey Maguire goes back to the 1990s to spread the message of... I like to picture him going to his friends after and be like, so I've been stuck in a TV. They're like, oh my God, he's on DMT. And then Reese Witherspoon decides to stay in Pleasantville.
Yes.
And that's where it ends.
And that is the movie.
Well, she decides to stay in Pleasantville and pursue her studies.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
She says, I've done the slut thing.
Yeah.
And now she wants to try something different.
Is also worth unpacking.
She's done. Yeah.
There's one word you haven't used in your description.
Mm.
Repressed.
Yeah.
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 That may be the ultimate adjective to describe all the people.
Right.
And the society in which they live.
Mm-hmm.
It is wholly and resolutely repressed.
Yes.
Not just sexually repressed, but repressed in other ways too.
Which seems to be what makes it so appealing to David in the first place, where there's that scene that I mostly liked where when they're still in the 90s and his mom is on the phone and she's having an argument about custody and all this stuff and he's just watching Pleasantville and totally ignoring it and repressing any of that. And you're like, oh, it makes sense that a very repressed environment would be appealing to him. It's like, oh, no one has problems, and if they do, it's not discussed.
Yeah.
Sounds like the kind of place I want to be. And he goes there.
Mm-hmm.
Where we know from the beginning that that's not Jennifer's deal at all. She's very forward about what she wants to do, and so of course she would hate it there.
Right. We got to take a quick break, but then we'll come right back after these messages.
Ooh. Bean Dad, The Dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture.
because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident, drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Okay, so the big thing about this movie, my big issue with it, and then we can talk about some of the other stuff, and we've already touched on this a little bit, but the movie attempts to become this metaphor for, because it's borrowing like language and imagery and other socially relevant things from civil rights era.
The race subplot on this viewing didn't do much for me, even though I understand, you know, contextually what they were trying to do. I just didn't feel like this setup lend itself particularly well to making the point that they were trying to make. And also that's introduced so late into the movie, right, where it's like the movie's almost over and they're like, no, now it's about race. And you're like, why? Like, what?
Right. Because the world that's been established, which makes sense for the context of what the show Pleasantville would be, which would be an entirely white cast.
Right.
But then that means that the world that everyone's existing in is made up entirely of white people, and then to introduce this race metaphor using only white people just doesn't work when we're watching it through the lens of 2019.
Yeah, that part of the movie did not age well for me. But we're curious what you
Well,
think.
It's all a matter of perspective. Having grown up then, mm-hmm. there were no black people on TV in those sitcoms that I can recall.
Right.
Certainly not in recurring roles, if at all. And being pre-civil rights, mm-hmm. which all of those shows were, although mm-hmm. some of them drifted into the era, that was, for many people, a definition and an absolute snapshot of American life.
I remember they did throw in, it sounds silly, but they threw in a couple of black people into the, like when you go to Pleasantville. That's like two, but they're there.
Oh, really?
Sometimes
But I think they did that. First of all, we are not big analyzers in general, because we watch so many movies. If we sat and went through absolutely everything, I think we'd all lose our minds. But also,
welcome to my life, our life.
But also, it's the kind of thing where I don't necessarily think that everything has to be analyzed deeply. And so for me, watching the movie, it would be weird if suddenly, instead of turning to color, they turned black. Like, that's not what you want to have happen. That's even stranger, you know?
But I just felt like that would have worked at all.
The racial...
I'm just saying, it's to work that in, since they do choose to go down a race road, it would have been stranger to suddenly have a black person pop up.
So I think the problem with this movie is that they are introducing this, like, civil rights metaphor into it, when they didn't need to do that. If it was just about sort of, like, the enlightenment of people in terms of, like, women's sexuality, which is a thing that gets established, and then they leave the race thing alone because they only have white people with which to carry out whatever metaphor they're trying to carry out.
It just felt mismatched.
Wouldn't they have taken a big hit if they hadn't addressed it at all?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the problem.
Yeah, I just think that there may have been a better way to do it. I don't know. And I don't have an idea as to what that may be. But it just felt like the movie bit off a little more than it could chew in terms of, like, addressing all the evils of this era.
Right.
It didn't seem equipped to address civil rights if one of the particular things about the movie is because it takes place in this all-white sitcom. It almost seemed like it for me, it attacks the women's sexuality and women's liberation so effectively that seems like it was very well equipped to do that and not so well equipped to deal with
civil rights.
Do you
remember feeling any of those things then?
The first time I saw it? No.
Right. Because that's the other part of it. And that's what is so tricky about looking back at movies.
Yeah.
Is that movie is now 20 years old, which is crazy.
Right.
First of all, that's crazy. But it's 20 years old. And it's really hard. And I think the reason that my dad and I are sort of used to turning certain parts off is because we watch old movies. My dad raised me on certain things. And there's definitely stuff that we'll watch sometimes that I can't. The Step and Fetch It characters, I have a really hard time with. Do you know that term?
Okay. No.
We saw it in Charlie Chan.
There were stereotypes.
Yeah.
Mm. Common stereotypes in movies for many decades. Every Irishman was a cop.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Every Chinese person was a laundryman or woman.
Yeah.
Every Italian was a grocer or a... fruit vendor or an organ grinder, if you can believe that. Every Greek person owned a diner. And every black person was a Pullman porter on railroad cars or a personal maid to a fancy white woman.
So Step and Fetch It.
Step and Fetch It was the name of a performer, a stage name of a performer. His name was Lincoln Perry, who played the laziest person on the planet.
So because that was his stage name, that became sort of a name used for that kind of a character. Mm-hmm. So Step and Fetch It. And you know Heckle and Jekyll and Dumbo?
Yeah.
That sort of a thing. But watching those today, I sometimes will watch something and I'll say to my dad, this is too much. Like, I can't. It hurts me to watch this. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we watch so many things where, I mean, you name it, happens. And so I think that we are used to turning parts off because you can't look at a movie with today's eyes. You just kind of can't.
We have to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
When we watch.
I see what you're saying. And I've had to when I go to watch movies at the theater, I often have to take off my Bechdelcast goggles just to enjoy anything.
Sure. Right.
But what we so often find when we do analyze movies for this podcast is that the movies that we've seen, pre-2018,
also 2018.
Right. They send messages or they erase certain things or they portray certain people in certain ways that have negatively impacted society at large. And on this podcast, we have to be like, when I watched, Indiana Jones growing up, that fucked me up. There's all these characters, white characters in brown face. There's all these, not good portrayals of women, you know, stuff like that. So, like, yeah, I know we have to, in order to enjoy any entertainment, kind of have to shut off our analytical brains sometimes. But
specifically, I mean, though, to me, when it's older, that I don't mean now, because if you walk in and see something like that now, you go, really, guys?
Right.
Really, guys?
Right.
But if you're even just 20 years ago, even there, you start to hit these kind of roadblocks.
I think there is a way to have it both ways.
Oh, absolutely.
A little bit. Yeah, absolutely. Where it's like when I watch, I totally agree with you, where when I watch movies for this show, I watch it differently than if I'm just enjoying it.
Sure.
Because otherwise, you know, it's just harder to enjoy things. Yeah. But it does, I don't know, it's been helpful for me. And it hasn't really, like, with some egregious exceptions, most of my favorite movies haven't necessarily changed as a result of turning off my compartmentalization to watch it. It's just, I don't know, just creates a more aware picture of something that I know I like. And it was, I mean, with this movie, which I still think is a good movie, and, you know, it's still one of your favorites, and it's just, I don't know, it is interesting, and
I think it's a very entertaining movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an entertaining movie that, I wouldn't call it a message movie, but it's a movie that makes a point or two.
Yeah.
So with the entertainment and the enjoyment. And some
the cast.
Of the,
such and, a good cast.
The cast.
Jenny Lewis Killer is cast. In this movie.
And, so weird. And production design, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Stunning. Gene Appelwall. That's the name
I told
you. Yeah, Gene Appelwall. Yeah. Who's brilliant. And it leaves you with something to chew on.
Right.
Yeah.
How hard you want to chew is up to you.
Yeah.
Right.
What I mean when I say that sort of the turning certain parts off, it's that we won't notice something. And then if you say, this made no sense, or I don't like how that worked out, for both of us, we'll sort of go, yeah, that is a thing. But when we watch something initially, we're pretty good at sort of not doing it.
So how does this movie fare on the Bechdel scale?
Well, we'll find that out shortly. There's still a bunch to talk about for me. So basically, I think the biggest issue I have with this movie, and then we can get into some other stuff that I think we think the movie does effectively, is just, again, to reiterate the fact that it's equating white people who have turned from being in, like, black and white to color, equating them to actual people of color, and then trying to make this metaphor just doesn't work when we're looking at it through today's lens. So
yeah, just a case of false equivalence, and then sort of a weird victory lap at the end of, like, we solved racism in Pleasantville. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that would be pretty easy to do here.
Right, because there are no people of color. It's only white people.
But with that, we're going to take a quick break and then talk about the portrayal of women.
Yeah.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Yerp. So in terms of the female characters in the movie, one of the first things that I noticed upon this rewatch that I guess was like kind of subconsciously aware of, but like hadn't given it much thought until watching the movie for the podcast. But I was like, oh, a woman's sexuality is what incites all the changes in Pleasantville. Like, that's the catalyst that gets things to start happening.
That's the catalyst. I mean, I think that there are some other things. I mean, women seem to prompt most of the changes inside. And there it was pretty sexually heavy at the beginning, where Jennifer is the one who I thought pretty effectively, you know, meets Skip and is forward and like, this is what I want to do. And, oh, you don't know how to do this? Here's how you do it. Want to do it? Great. Mm-hmm. And they do it. I should say do it more.
Yeah.
And then the same with Betty's character, who literally sets the town on fire by masturbating once.
Right.
But then that word repression.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how repressed she was.
Mm-hmm.
it's almost like a cartoon exaggeration.
Right.
But that's why it's such a funny moment.
Right.
It's a great, I mean, I love that. I forgot that moment happened because I just hadn't seen it in a few years. And I was like, oh my God, I guess that is what happens.
That is like the scene I remember from this movie.
Oh, wow.
Because it is, I think, the first movie I've ever seen where you see the suggestion of a woman masturbating.
I have, yeah, and incredibly
the suggestion
rare
of a woman having an orgasm in a movie. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the first time I had ever seen that. And I was like, oh,
what
shit.
What a difference 20 years can make.
Yeah.
No, but truly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and it's still, I mean, it's still not super common, but this was definitely one of the first movies where female masturbation was suggested.
Right.
And visually implied as well in a way that didn't seem like talking down to it, of like it literally is a catalyst
for change.
It's also
discreetly filmed.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh,
which,
yeah.
Which I love. I love the way that the thing that will drive us both nuts is anything gratuitous. And that is whether it's foul language where someone's saying fuck every 5 seconds and somehow that's supposed to be, you know, the script.
Funny or whatever.
No. It's lazy. Same kind of thing, nudity. When nudity fits and makes sense, none of us react to it, not in a big way.
Right.
When someone is standing there naked and you understand that it's because they want them to stand there naked, that's when I say, I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
So what I appreciate about that scene especially is we all understand. No one needs to see what she's doing. We all get it.
Right.
Right.
And whether it's, you know, whether it's just that she's pampering herself. That's the other part, too, is that if someone didn't know what she was doing, let's just say someone younger watching it didn't know what she was doing,
yeah,
they may just think that she's pampering herself, and she never does that.
Mm-hmm.
She's drawn a bubble bath.
Which narratively could work the same.
Absolutely.
Of just, like, yes, her doing something for, you know, herself.
Yeah, she, exactly. She lit candles there. She's in that bathtub having her time. So it could work either way.
I wouldn't have minded that, but I think the good thing about the I mean, I think it fits with the story too, where like, in what world of Pleasantville, the TV show, are you going to see like titties?
Yeah.
Not. And also it just allows it to be PG-13.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think this is like a cool movie for young women to see.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and like gratuitous female nudity is something that we come up against a lot of on this podcast.
Constantly.
Where we're like,
God.
And the other thing is that oftentimes female sexuality is something that's villainized in a movie, where a female villain will be like overly sexual, and that's something where we as the audience are meant to think like, oh no, she's like loose, and that's part of what makes her evil or whatever.
Right.
But in this movie, the female sexuality,
change.
It's what leads to an increased curiosity from like different people in the community to be like, basically like, what's a fire and why does it, what's the word?
I burn. My favorite thing, honestly, is Tobey Maguire going, fire!
Yeah.
Fire! Fire!
Cat?
And every time it makes me laugh, every single time.
Cats do have 8 nipples. This is Cat Facts
there you
with
go.
Caitlin.
And I think it would have been such an easy, lazy choice for the men to become sexually aware first and sort of gone in a more fratty direction with it.
Sure.
And the fact that Jennifer's character is basically the sex ed teacher for this entire world.
Yeah. Right.
Was really cool. And the fact that, I mean, and there were like little moments where I thought Jennifer was maybe the character was sort of talked down to and made to be like, oh, she's like a high school slut. Like that was sort of but she's so in charge of her own sexuality and so calling the shots at every point in the narrative.
Right.
And then where her character goes, where it seems like, I mean, the rules for what makes you technical aren't cut. I mean, it's just like some emotional response or something new that is fulfilling to you, because at first it seems like, oh, if you have sex now you're in Technicolor, but then that doesn't happen for Jennifer because she's been having sex, so it's like not new and exciting. And what is new and exciting is education and learning stuff, which was the one thing I was waiting to happen, because I had never watched this movie with this lens before of like, oh, it would be a bummer if it was only sex that, you know, activated women. But then you do see a few different things. And Jennifer's story was really, I don't know, I forgot that was her.
Well, narrative. The mayor turning color is that he gets angry.
Right.
But angry in such a serious way.
He becomes unpleasant.
Exactly. But that's it. Each person, as you say, it's something within them. So it depends on what you need.
It depends on who they had been established previously, and then they're once they undergo their character arc, whatever it may be, that's sort of what is the catalyst for their changing of colors.
And then for David, he changes colors when whenever I say changes colors, I think of the horse from The Wizard of Oz. But he changes colors when he has to defend his TV mom from the Pleasantville Proud Boys who are lunging at her because there was a nude painting done of her by Jeff Daniels, which does he ask her if that's cool or does he just do that?
We don't. That all happens off screen.
Okay.
And I have to
like
assume
she's
consenting to it.
It doesn't feel like he's done something terrible, clearly.
Right, because she's not
mad
at him.
She wanted it, and then she's there with him painting.
That's true.
Going off of, like, the Mary Sue character, like, having all of her agency and being sex positive, essentially, and, like, spreading the gift of sex to people, that then inspires the Betty character to also, like, have her agency when it comes to her sexuality, because she's the one who keeps approaching Bill Johnson, that's his name, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Jeff James.
And she keeps like going to him and saying like, let's experiment. I mean, we can presume a lot of this kind of happens off screen, but we do see her approaching him kind of with the intent of like, let's get naked.
The women in this movie are forward and state what they want. And usually the men are like, oh, sick.
But
yes.
then
that would be a great line in the film. Jeff Daniels just goes, oh, sick. You want me to paint you naked? Radical.
Someone says cool in this movie, and it's a big
cool
deal.
PJ.
Cool
PJ.
Yeah. Cool.
But then where the Mary Sue character leaves off, I don't know quite
I don't like
how to feel about this. Well, even before that, where first she's the one whose sexuality like sets the wheels in motion for the whole town of Pleasantville. But then later when she chooses like reading and studying over sex, and then she says later on, like, I tried the slut thing, it got kind of old.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
It's one. Great that she's like trying to enrich her life intellectually, but then that means she ends up sacrificing her sexuality, which,
well, we don't know if that's
kind of a mixed message.
I don't think that. I think okay. that yeah. I think that her saying I've done the slut thing is her sort of saying that I've tried different parts of myself. Mm-hmm. I've looked at different parts of myself. So now it's the sort of thing where you feel like she'll do it when she wants to. Mm-hmm. I think that's the difference, is as opposed to doing something because she has a reputation or she wants
she's trying
to be
cool. more popular.
You know, she has that, she's leading the women and stuff like that. It's in this case, she's sort of saying, this is what I want to do right now. In the same way that when Skip comes to her window, he's like, hey, hey, hey. And she's like, I'm studying. He said, but I thought we could go and do this. I'm studying. And she closes it.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's sort of, to me, it's more so that it's her saying, I've made the decision that this is my focus now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's saying like, and I'll never have sex again.
And the nunnery is next. Right. Because
we do see a shot of her at the very end at university. Mm-hmm. And she's like flirting with a man, and she's got a book open in her lap in front of her. So
she's having it all.
She's got it all.
It's great.
Another thing that kind of not necessarily rubbed me the wrong way, but is at least worth mentioning, is that the thing that gets Jennifer to want to play along in Pleasantville is a man. So it, like, and that makes sense for her character. Like, she had been established as this kind of like a boy crazy teen, but the fact remains that a woman is motivated in a movie to engage with what's happening in the story by a man.
Oh, I think you could say the same thing of the Betty character, if that's the yardstick we're using, because Betty gets... It's interesting because I love the relationship between Jennifer and Betty, and I almost wish we saw a little more of that, because the scenes we see them together in are so
they're great,
and they're talking to each other about stuff that women were not supposed to talk to each other about, and learning and educating each other. But then, I mean, I guess this would probably be realistic for that time, but Betty, you know, goes from one man to another man, and so it's a combination of, you know, she gets some of the motivation from what she learned from Jennifer, but would she have left her husband if there weren't a Jeff Daniels waiting in the wings? We don't know.
But see, we don't know that they get together. My dad and I were talking about this.
Oh, interesting.
Because you see that she goes to him, but we don't see her with him. And at no point do we see her, because we were just talking about this in the car.
Yeah.
She does what she wants to do. And if she did, what I feel like is if she did just go straight to Jeff Daniels, everything would sort of be lost.
Right.
Because then you go, well, all the stuff you just did, you just went from one man to the other.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We don't know that. And that's why the very end, where you see the three of them sitting on the bench.
On a park bench, yeah.
It's sort of like, yeah, she can do whatever she wants. So we don't really see anything.
I like that one better.
But that's it. You don't really see anything that tells you that now she's with him. Mm-hmm. We understand that they sort of had a romantic night, but we don't know what they're going to do from there.
He really Jack Dawson's her. A little bit. He does a Jack Dawson glass mural.
I want to paint you. Yeah. Hello.
That is a relief. I guess, I sort of was like projecting that foregone conclusion. I hope, that Betty's character, you know, she explores her options.
I think if she wants to get together with Bill, she can do that.
Yeah.
But the difference is wanting.
Right.
She wants to choose this person. Mm-hmm. And that is a big difference to everything else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
because her arc basically goes from her starting out as this like cheery housewife who's making the meals for the kids and the husband. She's
eat up.
Yeah. subscribing wholly to the status quo of Pleasantville. And then she learns about sexuality, and she knows her husband won't go for it. So she masturbates and pleasures herself.
Poor William H. Macy, when they cut back to him when she's in the bathroom and
he's
like
trying to get comfortable,
he's in his
like,
twin size bed, like, ah. So funny.
And then shortly after that, she turns to color, but she's too ashamed and she's not really ready to embrace this
another repression moment.
Right. So she covers herself all up with makeup.
And that's a very sweet moment, though.
Yeah, with her and
with her and Tobey Maguire. That's a very sweet moment.
It's a very tender.
Because on the one hand, obviously she's trying to hide that she's turned color. But at the same time, that's a really sweet moment with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, later on when Jeff Daniels rubs off the makeup, that's the other
weeping.
Right. Yeah. Like, you're beautiful just the way you are, exactly. Which right. is like.
I loved that scene with her and Tobey Maguire, especially because it was, I mean, you could see the repression and the shame of like, I've changed and I'm not ready for people to know that. And he, you know, even though he knows, you know, she may be happier if she, you know, is just herself in the world. He like accepts that she's not ready and
in
helps
that
her
moment,
out. And
it's not appropriate.
It's very nice.
She knows she will be ostracized.
Yeah. Yeah.
If not burned at the stake.
Yeah.
Right. You know? By the Pleasantville Proud Boys. Yeah.
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 Uh-huh.
Oh, boy.
And then where her arc ends is, well, before the kind of conclusion of her character arc, we see William H. Macy's character being like, where's my dinner? Like still expecting her to be like the homemaker caregiver role. And then whenever he confronts her about it, she's just like, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. Because he's like, lays down some like terms and conditions. Like, you're going to go to this town meeting. You're going to cook me dinner at 6 o'clock every day. Yeah. I like that he's made out to be like the doofus idiot who we're not supposed to like in that scene. And she's just like, no, I'm going to do whatever I want and you can't do anything about it.
Right. And I mean, and then you get the like sincere growth of his character too, where we see him be like, I don't know how to, I'm eating olives, which relatable.
Lots of olives.
Yeah.
Lots of them.
Yeah.
The scene in the courthouse where Tobey Maguire is talking to William H. Macy and in that moment saying, doesn't she look beautiful? Don't you love her? And he's crying and you're just like, oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Right.
Because there too, it's a nice thing. They don't make William H. Macy's character evil.
No.
He's not a bad man. Where the mayor is sort of seen as this oafish.
I think he's as close to a villain as we get.
That's it. Yeah. But William H. Macy, if he was terrible, then you would have no, leave him. Why would you want to be with that guy? But he's not that.
He's just clueless.
But this is also what he knows.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like in that courtroom scene where Tobey Maguire is trying to basically get William H. Macy to turn to color.
Yeah.
He's saying, like, it's not just the cooking and the cleaning that you enjoy. Maybe it's because you actually like her for her personality.
Yeah.
And it's like...
And it had never occurred to him
before. Which, like, is a very cartoonish thing, but also these are cartoonish characters.
I really ended up appreciating like the William H. Macy character, something that I don't think is super common in movies even now is to see a male character who has entirely the wrong idea about women, who is, you know, spoken to directly and then is made to seem capable of change. I feel like that is something I'd like to see more of in movies because it is like cathartic and exciting for me to see a guy be, you know, punished for being an asshole. And I'm all for seeing that. But also I think for like male moviegoers, especially like young male moviegoers, that can be a positive thing to see someone who is not treating women the way they should be, and then seeing them be called out and then begin to change and making that seem like a viable course of action is something that like younger boys should see more of.
Well, as much as I was concerned for Jesse growing up not having good female role models, I was also, just as a person, aware that there weren't very many good male role models either.
Almost none. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, which is crazy because there's so many.
You know, nuance, three-dimensional characters, something to pattern your life after. Oh, that guy really has his act together.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and he's smart, he's capable, he's I don't want to keep using the word enlightened, but that's the one that seems to come to mind.
Yeah. Sure.
And there are damn few of those.
Yeah.
Then or now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Something I love, and I thought about this then and I think about it now, but the whole thing of both Jeff Daniels and William H. Macy being good people means that it's not an easy decision. And the film that I always relate that to is The Notebook. Now, I'm not a diehard Notebook person. I like the movie fine, but I, you know, it...
Sure.
But I've always really appreciated that the two men she had to choose from were good men.
Ryan Gosling and James Marsden?
James Marsden.
Yeah.
Can you imagine
that is
choosing
a choice.
Between... It's ridiculous.
That is a choice.
But the whole thing is, you know, normally there's like you say, the Jack Dawson and, you know, and Rose, where she's with a terrible man. So there's no question. But there's no question that, you know, she should go to the other guy. It's much more complex to say... Both of these are good options.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so with Joan Allen, but that's if Joan Allen, you know, if William H. Macy's character was one dimensional and just like, I don't care about you, I just want my food, then it's no question. Go to the other guy.
Yeah.
But when you layer it and you say, no, it's not cut and dry like that. It's not that simple. I appreciate that. Yeah. I appreciate doing something different.
Absolutely.
You know?
And then I think with, like, the Tobey Maguire character in his different, like, whether he's being David or whether he's being Bud, like, he's a sensitive guy who is, like, there's a whole scene where he puts makeup on his mom. Like, how many, like.
But then the last scene with him and Jane Kasmirik.
Right, exactly.
Same thing.
Where so, he's comforting her because, you know, she's having romantic problems with her boyfriend or whatever.
Yeah. He's cleaning up her makeup.
Yeah.
So that's, it's obviously a callback that you see, you know, you see him with Joan Allen doing it. Now he's doing it with his real mom. But that makes that moment so much more tender.
Because you
believe, and I feel like.
And his character doesn't go from like bad to good. He just goes from repressed to less repressed.
Yeah.
Which is like a cool arc to see someone go through.
Any other final thoughts about the movie?
I think it holds up really well. In general, I think it holds up really well.
Mm-hmm.
The performances still all feel real.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. The pieces, even if the whole is not perfect, to me, the pieces are absolutely worth it. And if you can sort of deal with the other stuff, of course, someone watching it for the first time is going to have a completely different experience. And that's true of all movies.
Sure.
If you love something, you love it. And so I can't look at it now and say, well, let me be completely objective. I can't. Mm-hmm. I love the movie. I've seen it a million times.
Right.
But I do think, compared to some especially, it holds up well.
Yeah, I think aside from like the very like late 90s idea of like progressivism of like...
Sure.
White people who turned to Technicolor is the same thing as the civil rights movement. But aside from that, like, yeah, I do genuinely think this movie holds up pretty well. I still enjoy it. I'll still watch it. I just have to point out that there's like trivia in the beginning where David's like practicing for the marathon. And one of the questions is, what did Bud and Mary Sue name the cat that they found in the gutter?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is Marmalade, which
I thought of you for that.
You know, Paddington is his favorite food, so just have to just shout out to Paddington.
Is there a part you feel like Alfred Molina would have played well in this movie?
Oh, I think he would have been a good mayor because he's you know what? He plays basically
casting him as the villain.
Well, he plays basically that same character in Chocolat.
I know.
I'd like to see him as Mr. Johnson.
I was gonna say I love Jeff Daniels, but I love Alfred Molina in a romantic role.
Sure. Yeah.
That would be my pick.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's my final thought on the movie.
Does this movie pass the Bechdel test?
Yes.
It does. It does a couple times. A few of them are just like very throwaway moments where Joan Allen is like, I just love that sweater on you, Mary Sue. It's so flattering.
She says, thanks.
Thanks. and then there's a couple other like, have breakfast now or like, get off to school.
Okay.
And she's like, oh, I'm not hungry. But the big scene is the one where Jennifer as Mary Sue is teaching Joan Allen's character about sex.
They're doing the dishes.
Yeah, they're doing household chores.
Yeah.
But they're talking about masturbation, which begs the question, where did Mary Sue and Bud come from if Joan Allen's character has never had sex?
They live in a universe where
storks,
they started, just started
that's
by existing.
Your problem with two people going into a TV show. Yes. Where's the sex happening?
Why aren't they having sex? I guess it's just like the stork
just
brings
appear.
The baby.
That's the whole thing.
Doorstep.
They all showed
just
up
appear.
When season one started and right. they were the way they were.
That's right.
So, but yeah, there's a fairly long scene where she's like, yeah, again, what they're talking about heterosex. So
sure. Yeah.
Whether or not that passes the Bechdel test is up for debate because she's talking about like having sex with a man.
But then
it turns to masturbation.
I would give that scene a pass for that reason. Yeah.
I think so.
Like the context for me is like sex for pleasure. And like sex for female pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. It's not about men, it's about them.
Yeah.
The man is the tool, literally. Right. But
he's the vessel.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll give this a pass for sure.
Yeah. So I just loved that scene in general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Same.
Shall we rate the movie?
Let's rate it on our nipple scale, 0 to 5 nipples, based on its portrayal of women. I think I'm going to go with a 3. I'm going to take some nipples off because of the whole discussion we've already had regarding like, oh, white people solving racism. That's my big problem with the movie. But then the female characters who have agency, especially in terms of their own sexuality. The Margaret character we didn't really talk about a lot or at all, but that's the teen woman who Bud
Marley
ends
Shelton.
Up yeah, yeah ends up dating. She kind of really only exists in the story to kind of like further develop Bud's character,
right.
And she doesn't really have any bearing on the story, so she's just kind of like one of these sort of flat one-dimensional characters. But yeah, of the characters, we do get to know Betty and Mary Sue / Jennifer. Yeah, I really like the message that they help perpetuate in the story. So I'll give it 3 nipples, and I'll give all of them to the cat named Marmalade, who we never meet on screen. Although maybe that's the cat that gets saved by the firemen in the very beginning.
Could Marmalade be. Visibility is high.
Yes.
I'm going to strictly do this rating based on how this movie treats women, because I mean, I also did not care for the way this movie tried to throw in civil rights in kind of this bizarro way. But strictly based on how the movie treats women, I'm going to give it a 4, only docking it really for the B characters that are kind of a little bit tropey, like the you know, the friends in the 90s and the 50s mm-hmm. are kind of, you know, like reductive bimbo-y characters. And then I sort of agree with you about Margaret's character. It seemed like there was more there, but there just wasn't time or real estate given.
But they are very sweet together.
Yeah, they were definitely sweet. I don't know anything about that character outside of she's sort of, you know, there to move his storyline forward.
Is there also like a Garden of Eden reference where she's like, here, take
with
that
the red apple.
Apple.
Oh, you bet there is.
Oh, yeah. Biblical imagery. I mean, the Bible is, of course, a feminist text. in general, I really like that women becoming less repressed and challenging norms is the catalyst for really most of the change in the movie. And I thought it was really well done. I still enjoy it. So I'll do 4.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give 1 to Reese, 2 to Joan, and 1 to Paul Walker. Because why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
R.I.P.
Yeah.
4 nipples, yeah.
Cool.
Solid 4.
Yeah.
I'd give it a solid 4, too, on that basis. Yes.
Cool.
Sounds great.
Awesome.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Loved having you. Is there anything you would like to plug? Where can people follow you online?
He is at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram, and he has a Facebook page, and there's leonardmaltin.com, mm-hmm. and he writes movie reviews there and does book roundups and that type of stuff. And then May 10, 11, 12 is Maltin Fest.
Ooh.
Tell us about our very first film festival. That's exciting. It's a hidden gem film festival. So we're not showing new stuff. We're
showing recent movies that flew under the radar for
recent,
most people.
But also some older ones, just to keep things interesting. But yeah, it's the idea of just it's film appreciation, and our goal always in kind of everything we do is community. Mm-hmm. The internet does not treat people don't treat each other very nicely. And and I think that it's really important to continually get them away from the computer and into real life.
We want to bring people together.
Yeah.
Movie lovers.
You want to take them out of Pleasantville, the show they're stuck in.
That's right.
To put them into the real world.
We're going to bring people together. We're going to do it in the heart of Hollywood.
Yep.
At the Egyptian Theater.
That's so exciting.
So, we're very excited about it.
And it's over Mother's Day weekend.
Cool.
So on the Sunday, my mom, we're having like a Mother's Day thing for her, and
Lovely.
Yeah.
That's so
cool. We'll check that out and listen to Malton on Movies. Mm-hmm. And thanks again for being
here.
Thank you
so much. Thanks for having us.
You can follow us on social media at Bechdelcast. You can go to our website, bechdelcast.com. We've got our episodes there. We've got our merch store there.
Merch?
Yeah.
Like what's on my merch?
Like what you're wearing right now.
Oh, yes. Jesse came correct.
That's right. Obviously. I bought this right after we first met.
No way!
The day of Meltdown when we had Alfred Molina on our show.
Wow.
And that's the day we met you guys.
That is actually necessary context for this episode was, Aristotle.
The world's best engineer.
The world's best engineer, a shared engineer at the table, found out through Jesse that Alfred Molina was going to be on Malton on Movies. So I took the day off. Caitlin and I went to Meltdown and I totally wimped out and I was too afraid to talk to him. Fast forward a year and a half, he was on the show.
Wow.
And now we're best friends. The loveliest human being.
He's perfect.
Such a delight.
I adore him. I absolutely adore him.
Oh, he's
and of course, an astonishing actor.
Oh my God. One of the greatest actors, honestly, living. He's incredible.
Totally agree. Friend of the show, Alfred Molina.
Speaking of, you can get feminist icon Alfred Molina merch. We've also got.
Which he was low key horrified by.
I think he loved it. You can get other merch designs like queer icon, feminist icon, strong female protagonist, as well as a few newer ones.
The whole bit, yeah. So check out our TeePublic store as well.
We have merch on TeePublic.
Oh, hell yeah.
Movies, yep.
Grab some of that while you're at it.
Merch it up.
And also don't forget about our Patreon, aka Matreon. You can go to patreon.com/Bechdelcast. It's $5 a month and you get 2 bonus episodes every month, including all of the backlog of all of our past Matreon episodes.
We're addicted to creating content. We simply can't stop.
Addicted. Yeah. So check that out and we'll be here next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.